Coming up, persecution of Christians in many places around the world taking a devastating toll. Also, David Tereshchuk on a congregation of deaf Catholics in New York fighting to survive. And New York filmmaker Menachem Daum on a Holocaust survivor's return to Poland, where the Holocaust killed 3 million Jews.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy, and it's good to have you with us. People of faith were among those taking part in protests and vigils after an unarmed African-American man was shot and killed by a white police officer in South Carolina. The officer claimed self-defense, but a bystander's video showed the officer shot 8 times at the man's back as he fled. The officer was charged with murder and fired after the video came to light. Several religious leaders called for more justice and transparency in law enforcement, citing Ferguson and other incidents involving unarmed black men. This coming week, a federal jury in Massachusetts will consider whether 21-year-old Johar Tsarnaev should get the death penalty after he was found guilty on all 30 counts for his role in the 2013 Boston Marathon bombing. 3 people were killed and 264 others wounded in the attack. Some faith leaders are urging that Tsarnaev's life be spared. The Catholic bishops of Massachusetts emphasize the church's opposition to the death penalty. As Western Christians celebrated Easter last week, and Eastern Orthodox Christians do so this weekend, the issue of religious persecution has been weighing heavily for many. Security was raised around churches in Kenya after last week's massacre that targeted Christians at a college. Nearly 150 people were killed and dozens injured in the attack by members of the Al-Shabaab terrorist group. Special prayers and vigils have been held for the victims, many of whom were singled out because of their Christian faith. In the Middle East, church leaders urged hope despite the ISIS violence that has targeted their communities. Many renewed calls for a temporary protected zone in the region. During several weekend services at the Vatican, Pope Francis urged the world not to look away or be silent in the face of Christian persecution. Joining me now with more on this is our managing editor, Kim Lawton, and Father Thomas Rees, senior analyst at the National Catholic Reporter and a member of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. Tom, Kim, welcome. Tom, welcome back here. And how do you see this, all this killing that's going on?
It's amazing. I mean, we have not seen this kind of attacks on Christians all over the world in a long time. You know, we have more Christians being killed now than were killed during the Roman persecutions. It's devastating on the Christian community in the Middle East and Africa and other parts of the world. We have Al-Shabaab going after Christians in Kenya. We have Boko Haram going after Christians in Nigeria, ISIS going after Christians in Syria and Iraq. It's been a really, really bad time for Christians.
I've traveled to some of these places, and it's a real struggle for the church leaders in some of these areas because they urge their flock to please don't leave, but the families are, you know, in danger and they want to leave. How big of a challenge is this for religious leaders on the ground to try to maintain their community in the face of this?
Well, it's especially an issue in the Middle East. I mean, this in the Holy Land, this is the cradle of Christianity. And there's a possibility that Christians might disappear from the Middle East. So this is a real crisis for the Christian community. Anybody who's a Christian and knows English or another language and has any kind of education, they want to get out. They want to get out. And who's stuck there are the elderly, the poor, those who can't get out.
what can other Christians, what can people generally in governments do?
Well, I think we have to keep our eye on this. We have to focus the attention of the world on the crisis that Christians face. Everybody's pushing their own agendas, whatever they are. And we need governments to recognize that this is an issue they have to deal with. They have to be there to protect Christians and Muslims and Jews and, you know, Hindus and Buddhists, because there are religious groups being persecuted in all parts of the world. This is a real issue that should be a priority for governments and nonprofits all over the world.
Can you talk at all about what the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom is going to do about this?
Well, I can't speak for the commission. I can only speak as an individual member of the commission. But we want to bring the focus of attention of the world on these issues. We want to urge the United States government to make this a priority, you know, so that when we're talking to other political leaders around the world, we're not just talking about national security and trade, but human rights and religious freedom is high on the agenda.
And how hard is it, though, to get the U.S. government to make it high on the agenda when there are a lot of interest groups pushing a lot of things, as you said?
Well, it is difficult. But I think that, you know, there's the desire to do this, but it just kind of gets dropped down, you know, lower on the priority list. And I think we have to insist that it be up there high on the priority list. And it's things like saying the police need to be trained to deal with these. Because a lot of times it's not the government that's persecuting people. It's mobs. And what Christians and other religious groups need is police protection. You know, and people need to be arrested when they do these kinds of things and not just left alone. So these are the kinds of things that our government needs to push for.
And very briefly, some Christians in the Middle East, in particular in Syria and Iraq, have been pushing for a temporary, you know, safety zone. Do you think that's a good idea?
Well, when you're being shot at, you know, you need something like that. You need some kind of a safety zone, some kind of protection. That's not a permanent solution. You can't just ghettoize people. I mean, what we have to learn is how do we live together as brothers and sisters, because that's what we are.
Tom, it's wonderful to see you again. Kim, to both of you, thanks. In other news, President Obama hosted the annual Easter prayer breakfast at the White House with many prominent Christian leaders in attendance. He spoke about the Easter themes of hope and joy.
Easter is our affirmation that there are better days ahead. And also a reminder that it is on us, the living, to make them so.
Reverend Gardner C. Taylor, considered one of the best preachers in America, died this week at the age of 96. The longtime pastor of Concord Baptist Church in Brooklyn, Taylor and his friend Martin Luther King, Jr., helped found the Progressive National Baptist Convention. Kim Lawton profiled Taylor in 2006.
He says preaching is always a tenuous endeavor.
It is quickly lost. It's uttered, heard, and sometimes lost. But it is the mystery of preaching that it survives. And that it has survived so much of our bad preaching.
Taylor remained involved in social issues. Looking back, he admits at times he may have been too involved with Democratic Party politics. But he also worries that many contemporary churches have lost their prophetic edge.
When a pulpit becomes an echo of the pew, it loses, I think, almost all of its reason for existence.
Sickness and sorrow, and pain and death are felt and feared. God shall wipe away all tears.
We have a story today from David Tereshchuk about a Catholic church in New York City that the Archdiocese wants to close to save money, but that the congregation is determined to try to save. The situation is especially poignant because of the reason the congregation wants so strongly to stay together.
Holy Mass begins in a New York church that is threatened with closure. Catholic authorities throughout the country are shutting down and merging parishes as they trim budgets. But here, the Archdiocese of New York has targeted a church with a very distinctive character.
We praise you, bless you, adore you, glorify you.
It's St. Elizabeth's on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, and it caters to a specific congregation of deaf people. That congregation is now fighting the closure decision.
I refuse to let that happen. No. It's not right. Hearing people, if one church is closed, they go another one close. They could go to that church. But we don't have any different church to go to. We have one church. I refuse to let the church close.
St. Elizabeth's is far from alone in being designated to close. The Archdiocese has announced similar plans affecting about 100 churches. Parish priest Father Patrick McCahill, who has been fluent in sign language since his seminary days, thought his church would have escaped the budget cuts.
Frankly, I was a bit naive. I thought the special services we provided for deaf people would kind of save us, basically.
Nationally and across all denominations, there is scant provision for deaf worshippers. St. Elizabeth's, though, is notable for being dedicated to the deaf and in all sorts of ways. As well as special prayer and ritual, the church also offers a lively social center.
They feel very much at home. This is their spiritual home. They will use that term all the time.
Our parishioners come from throughout New York City, Westchester, and the Lower Hudson Valley to St. Elizabeth's here because of its central location.
Some of them will get here at 6 o'clock in the morning, and they'll stay here until 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It's where they belong. It's where they feel comfortable. It's where they can communicate easily, where they're accepted for being who they are.
On the spiritual side, one very distinctive element in St. Elizabeth's ministry is a deaf choir. The hymns they perform are not sung, they're signed.
So a choir for the deaf is important, for it helps us to connect to God. Because the people are looking, they're paying attention, and they join. So that makes me feel good.
Under the Archdiocese plan, when the church closes, everyone would move to worship at a neighboring church. That would be 6 blocks away, at St. Monica's Parish Church. But, says McCahill, St. Monica's is simply not as well suited to the needs of deaf people as St. Elizabeth's. Those needs, of course, are mainly visual.
This is a lovely church, but it's also much bigger. The altar is much larger. The pews are much further back. You have people kind of straining their necks to look up. You have behind me very lovely marble work, but again, it's very busy. If you want people to pay attention to the signing, things have to be as simple as they can be behind the signer.
There are other practical drawbacks to St. Monica's, according to St. Elizabeth's lay trustees, like Calman Cheney.
It's more like a cathedral. It's very large. Its social hall, unlike ours, though, is not handicap accessible, and it currently does not comply with the New York City building code.
Perhaps ironically, the Archdiocese headquarters from which the closure decree was issued is named for a previous New York Archbishop, Cardinal Terence Cook, who first designated St. Elizabeth as a place for special deaf ministry 35 years ago. The current Archbishop, Cardinal Timothy Dolan, wouldn't talk with us, but in response to the outcry of protest over St. Elizabeth's, he has let it be known that his administration can be flexible. The official word from the Archdiocese now is that if the needs of the deaf congregation cannot be met at the alternative church that's been nominated, then they will get met somewhere else. But at St. Elizabeth's, that's not satisfying anyone. The church's uniqueness, they feel, cannot be replicated in combination with any other church.
Here, unlike other parishes, the deaf have priority. Other churches, to make ends meet, rent out their facilities. This parish here financially keeps things going for the deaf to have their ministry here.
So the congregation is now going over the head of even their Cardinal Archbishop. Catholic canon law says they can petition the Pope to get the closure decision reversed. Orders from Rome to reverse an archbishop's decree are extremely rare. But they do happen, and St. Elizabeth's worshippers draw encouragement from Pope Francis and his well-demonstrated concern for the deaf, among other communities with physical challenges. Another lay leader, Margaret Shea, is hopeful Rome will recognize her church should continue its special ministry without having to move.
We have a right to the sacrament, so we could do that here. We do God's work all over. We're the same as hearing people. We need all of that.
And you need it in your own place, not somewhere else.
Right. Yes. If it's God's will.
God's will may be just what they have to rely on. St. Elizabeth's, as well as other New York churches trying to resist closure, feel they've met bureaucratic obstacles in arguing their case. Father McGahill, though, fully expects that ultimately the voice of the deaf will be heard.
You know, Jesus is still in charge of his church. He is still able to change hearts and minds. That's ultimately the hope in all of this.
For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is David Tereshchuk in New York City.
On our calendar this week, Jews around the world end their 8-day celebration of Passover. As we mentioned earlier, Eastern Orthodox Christians who follow a different calendar from the West have been observing Holy Week, culminating this Sunday with Easter or Pascha. Many Sikhs and Hindus celebrate Vaisakhi, a spring harvest festival that marks the new year. Next week is Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day. And we have a personal story from New York filmmaker Menachem Daum. For many Jews, Poland has long been associated with anti-Semitism. 3 million Polish Jews perished in the Holocaust. Last year, the Polish government opened a huge new museum dedicated to the contributions of Jews to Polish history. That prompted Dasha Rittenberg of New York City, a Holocaust survivor, to go back to Poland to see for herself whether and how it had changed. Menachem Daum went with her as she experienced a welcome that surprised her.
For many Jews, Poland is inextricably associated with the Holocaust and little else. So when I heard Poland was about to open up a museum telling the thousand-year history of Polish Jewish life, I decided it was time to take a fresh look.
Makes the great synagogue.
To get a better idea of how Poland has changed since the war, I went along with Dasha, a Holocaust survivor who lives in New York. For Dasha, the holiest site on our pilgrimage was her hometown of Benzin, especially the site of her grandfather's grave.
It's like saying goodbye for good this time. Because I don't think I will ever, no matter how much longer I will live from now on, I don't think I'll ever come back here. No, that's it. That's the last. It's a nice place, isn't it? No, this is a Heuchelstein.
Our difficulty finding her grandfather's grave was making Dasha increasingly nervous. When we finally found him, her relief was palpable. In Benzin, we met Piotr and Karolina, a Polish couple who preserve their town's Jewish history.
A tu jest pani Karolina. Karolina. No, bardzo dziękuję, że mi odwiedza.
Piotr and Karolina have a special place they want Dasha to see. This apartment was once used for Jewish prayers. Piotr and Karolina rent it to keep the landlord from painting it over. They bring local students here to teach them about the Jews who once lived in their town.
We believe it's so important for the history of Benjin, for our common history. We are not Jewish.
We are doing it, that's what Gutrek said, because it's a part of our history. My grandparents are from Benjin, grandparents, great-grandparents are from Benjin. So the Jews from here were neighbors of them, so...
Yeah, they were building this town, they were building the houses, they actually built this and a city, entire city, so we owe it to them. You say, this whole Jewish history of Benjin, of the region, was forgotten, and this is what I couldn't agree with. After the war, it was like erased totally, and it was like agreeing with Hitler that what he did, he wanted it, and after the war, during the communism time, we continued this policy. We decided that it can't go on like that.
This idea that Polish Jewish history is an essential part of Poland's own history was emphasized repeatedly at the opening of the Museum of the History of Polish Jews.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the Republic of Poland and the President of the State of Israel align wreaths from Polish and Israeli nations at the monument to the ghetto heroes.
Nie da się zrozumieć i w pełni przeżyć historii Polski bez znajomości historii Żydów polskich. Wynika to nie tylko z wielowiekowej obecności Żydów na naszych ziemiach, ale i ze znaczenia społeczności żydowskiej w wielu dziedzinach polskiego życia, w gospodarce, w kulturze, w nauce.
The Polish speech was so wonderful, was so recognizing us, recognizing me. I was part of all that contribution that Polish Jewry made to this country. I was very proud. Yes, I was. It was wonderful.
I see this museum as the face of the new Poland. This is not the post-communist period. This is a post-communist period. And it is really a different period. This is a period where 40% of the population is going to university. People are speaking English, they're cosmopolitan, they're educated. It's a different generation. I think it really reflects a whole new era.
When I met the bishop and the priest, it was wonderful. The fact that I had a bishop putting his arms around me, a Jewish child who was always afraid of churches, who was always afraid of Poles, I was. Who always, when I saw a few boys together, I was always afraid they may throw stones at me. I was told to go to the other side of the street. I grew up in fears, I did. I grew up in fears over my father because he had a beard, and my brothers who had payas and were Hasidim. And we were always happy to see them back home, that nothing happened to them. And here is this bishop, the symbol of the church, putting his arms around me. It felt good. It really did. Not to be just the opposite. I felt that he was happy to see me. I it felt good. Kind of mixed feelings, but it felt good. And I'm going away with a different feeling, seeing different changes. They're unbelievable. I'm so respectful of it. I hope, as old as I am, that I will still make another trip. I don't know. The perception has changed by both the Poles and the Jews.
Seeing Poland and the museum through a survivor's eyes makes it clear that hatred doesn't always have to be passed on from generation to generation. Perhaps no one is more qualified to set such an example than Poles and Jews. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Menachem Daum.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website, including Kim's full profile of Reverend Gardner C. Taylor. You can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, more scenes from this year's Holy Week around the world.
Filio e Spirito Santo.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.